Welcome to the Sanctuary Podcast, hosted by Angel Deer. In this podcast, we explore the mysteries of spirituality and consciousness. In each episode, we dive deep into the realms of human experiences, our rapidly changing world, and the unseen realms, tapping into the universal wisdom that connects us all. Whether you're a seasoned spiritual seeker, starting to awaken to the possibilities of a more expansive reality, or want support on your journey, this podcast is for you. Join me as we explore topics such as shamanism, spiritual transformation, holistic healing, the medicine path, energy healing, plant medicine, ancient wisdom, and more. Our guests are respected elders and experts in their fields, and we'll learn from their insights and experiences as we journey together on the path of spiritual growth. If you can, please consider supporting this podcast by joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Once again, it is patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Now, let's dive into today's episode.
So what's missing is the basic felt understanding that, in the words of Chief Seattle, what we do to the web of life, we do to ourselves. That's, you know, that fundamental experience of as it is with ecology, so is it with me. As it is with you, so it is with me. As you suffer, so I suffer. That basic felt experience we can't rationalize our way there, right? It's something that has to be felt. And because human beings are the beings that we are, with our intense longings and urges, it has to be ritualized. We have to ritualize our experience of that deep interconnectivity. We need intensity in that ritual process. We need for the ritual process to like work with these deep primal longings that we have, and, you know, blast through us in a way and shatter us sometimes. I'm sure you've been in ritual that has shattered you, right? Shatter us and then regrow us, but regrow us as interconnected with one another so that we feel the potency of community, right? And all that need for intensity and all that need for, you know, that fire is alchemized. It's harnessed. It's harnessed in the fire of ritual. It's harnessed in the fire of art. It's harnessed in the fire of communal endeavor.
Good morning, everyone. And pleasure to be here today with Josh. And Josh, how are you doing today?
Doing really well. Thanks for having me, and thanks for your patience, and glad to be here.
Yeah, I will assume that people that are listening know about your podcast, so I won't praise it for more than a few minutes. But I have to say that this is how I discovered you, and somehow realized we have many friends in common. But I really recommend people that are listening to, you know, have a look at the Emerald Podcast. Josh is doing really an amazing work to bring myth, poetry, and kind of a very interesting eye on the state of the world, I would say, and where we are at in our communities, in our countries, in our families at the moment. So Josh, before we dive in, I have some topics I want to explore with you, but I would love you to share about this passion for myth and poetry. How did it started? Were you always interested in it, or was it an influx point where you felt like, okay, this is the direction of my life, I'm going to dive more into it?
It's been there for me since the very beginning. So I was raised in a Zen Buddhist household, and my parents were pretty serious practitioners, and along with that came a wealth of stories and myths and tales. So the actual practice of Zen Buddhism is obviously very simple and somewhat, you know, stark, just a person and a meditation cushion and a blank wall. But surrounding all that is a wealth of talking animals and water spirits and ogres and people chasing little bouncing rice cakes down into the underworld and this type of thing. And that, you know, while my parents were focused on, you could say, the serene and meditative aspects of the tradition, for me, the stories just leapt to life. And so I was raised immersed in story and, you know, story that was rooted in an animate world. And I drew like every little kid draws, and I would draw mythic lands and characters from the myths that I was studying and or that I was hearing as bedtime stories. And it was just infused in me from a very early age. And then when I was 13, we went and lived in India. And that just blew my mythic mind. So I grew up raised and steeped in mythic tradition and inanimate tradition. And then I think, like many people in the modern world, as I hit my 20s and was expected to kind of integrate into society, like myth, that mythic animate vision, I struggled somewhat to integrate it, to know what to do with that whole side of myself. And, you know, I worked in music, I worked in activism, I found ways to thread it in. But I think that many of us have a mythic animate longing, a kind of deep substrate of the mythopoetic, you could call it. And or like you could call it a bardic inclination. We're drawn to seeing the world through mythopoetic eyes. And I think for many of us, there is a struggle of integration. There's a struggle of, like, you know, how does the mythic bard meet the modern world, and how do we integrate, and how do we integrate in a meaningful way, in a way that's not just, you know, navel gazing, as they say, or like, you know, staring off into space. And that took me years to find. That took me many, many years to find. Souls that are drawn to that way of seeing the world in the modern world, I think, have to go on a journey. And that journey of how to integrate it can take a really long time. Mm-hmm. So it's been there from the beginning. And then it's really only in the last, you know, 10 years or so that I felt that it really kind of converged and I was able to integrate it fully into my life.
Mm, beautiful. You know, someone the other day told me, say, what was your favorite tale when you were little? And look at your life today, because very often you will see that whatever favorite stories you had, this is who you became as an adult. And in some ways, all your life kind of weaved itself into that ancient tales, because there was some resonance with your soul, maybe at an early age, or, you know, whatever the reason. So my question is, did you have a favorite tale or favorite myth, or is there one at the time, maybe that's changed today, but when you were young, something that really you could identify, you wanted to live with that character in that story?
That's a hard one for me to pick just one, because I grew up with a lot of stories. But I really appreciated and loved the stories of the Mahabharata in India, and the animate world that it presents, while presenting enough kind of, you could say, like heroic warrior stories for a 13-year-old boy to be like fascinated by. But I loved the, like, you know, next thing you know, they're in a realm populated by snake spirits, and in that realm populated by snake spirits, there's a snake king, and there's an entire snake court, and there's the depth of character and the depth of, like, you know, not only the generalized feeling that there's an animate world, but the specificity of that world, and the specificity of, like, outlining and mapping all the various levels of existence, and not only all the levels of existence, but all the places within inanimate landscape where certain beings live, and these beings live here and this. So I used to draw huge, like, imaginary maps and map out these mythical worlds myself. And, like, for me, and Tolkien obviously was deeply influential from a very, very early age. I have a very early memory of, you know, being like 11 years old and a friend of my parents, we were camping and sitting by a fire, and he was reading The Return of the King to me out loud, and it was raining and he was sheltering me with his poncho. And it was a scene where Gandalf was like sheltering Pippin from the rain as they were riding. And I remember that just imprinting on me, the fire and the story. And so I would say, like, what probably imprinted on me more than anything else, rather than like the specific story, was more like what you could call a sense of vastness, a sense of realms within realms within realms, and places within places within places. And turn that corner and then all of a sudden an entire realm opens up, or like Narnia, step into that wardrobe and before you know it, you're in a different land. And of course, this is the fundamental experience of human consciousness if we take the time to explore it enough, right? This is how consciousness works. It's layers within layers within layers. It's realms within realms within realms. And I love what you're saying about how, you know, a story shapes us, because I think it's something that people in the modern world live a little bit blind to, which is that everything that transpires is being shaped by a mythic narrative in one way or another. Like the way we build societies, the way we build communities, the way we interact with each other, there's story behind all of it. And, you know, I think we've lost a little bit of our ability to see that and to parse out, like, oh, I'm following along a particular mythic narrative, and American culture is following a particular mythic narrative, and the struggles between nations, these are struggles between mythic narratives, and everything unfolds according to myth and story. We build our lives around it entirely. So for me, it's important to reconnect to that vastness, to understand that there are worlds within worlds within worlds within worlds, and that those worlds, again, aren't, abstract la-la lands. Those worlds are absolutely essential for us for understanding how to navigate our daily lives, how to navigate this world.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, people that are here, you know, are interested in that topic, but, and probably wherever you speak or ask to spoke, and people are interested in that vision, but do you feel also confronted with resistance to see the world with those different layers, right? I feel we're in a world that's very materialistic, that's very about concrete and plastic and metal and machines and AI and, you know, things that are artificial to a sense, but, you know, human created. So maybe they're not that artificial, but where the mythopoetic seems pretty dry very often, or that we are missing it. For me, returning to myth when I'm having a bad day, reading a story really feel like it's nourishing me when I felt my heart, my soul dry. It's a way to return. But do you feel sometime that difficulty for the modern world, as we call it, to understand the necessity that a native culture, ancient culture, many cultures around the world still see as a validity and importance to dwell in those stories and to have those myths present in the actual world we're in?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a tremendous resistance to it. And then I also think the understanding of the necessity of it is growing. So yes, there's a tremendous resistance to it. And we've, you know, we, meaning modern Western industrialized culture, has labeled itself like the pinnacle of all the ages, the pinnacle of human experience, the ones who really know what's going on, the rationalists. And meanwhile, our world is an absolute mess and we can't stop fighting each other. And, you know, we have this mythic narrative that tells us that everything that we do is kind of governed by some type of rationality or reason and look at the world today, and you see that that's just absolutely not the case. That's not the primary driving force within human beings. And what drives human beings is much deeper, and it's much more poetic, and there's much more longing involved. And, you know, until we reconcile these two things, the world is going to continue to be a mess, because ultimately human beings need to understand those deeper longings and deeper chthonic drives and have myths and rituals that allow us to express them and harmonize with the world around us. So there's resistance, sure. And then what you also see is that the what you could call the promises of modernity are failing. Like the great vision, I don't know if anyone's noticed, but the great vision of how this was supposed to all turn out is tanking. Let's just say it's tanking. And you know, I was in San Francisco recently for a conference to discuss some of the mythic implications of AI. And the AI episode did cross over into some of those spheres that tend to be resistant to this kind of thinking. And that's been interesting to see. But I was there, and I was there on a day when a piece of writing came out from a tech entrepreneur called the Techno Optimists Manifesto, and basically talking about, you know, rehashing the same old progress narratives and saying, you know, technology is going to take us from mud huts to the stars and this kind of thing. And, you know, why is everybody so down on all this stuff? It's like, look at it, this great future that awaits us. And I'm reading this on the way to the conference. And meanwhile, I'm walking through the streets of San Francisco, and there's people living in dire poverty out on the street, and self-driving cars and this kind of odd dystopian. There was no way you could talk about it as utopian. It was clearly dystopian. Mm-hmm. You know, the world is a mess, in case anyone hasn't noticed. And so within that, we need to reevaluate some basic assumptions of the way that we interact with the world and see the world, right? It's not a story of just like, oh, if only we could rationally just, if everyone could behave rationally, then everything would be fine. You know, there were philosophers that tried to say that at a certain point, and you know, they were also notoriously miserable. They're like, if only everyone would just follow the rational, right? Yeah, well, nice thinking, but that's not what human beings are. Mm-hmm. You know, we're deeper than that. So as much as there is resistance and the tendency to want to, I'd say, kind of preserve a world of compartments and boxes, there is also a deep longing for a return to what you could call the vital breath of life. Mm. You know, the vital breath of life, and how it moves between you and I, and how it moves between us and our communities and us and the ecosystem around us. And this reconnection to the living breath of life, not as an abstraction, but as something that's present here, that informs our ethics and our ritual structures and our communal structures. Mm. There's a deep longing for it, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. One of the episodes that really moved me from you was, I think, last year, about war and rite of passage. And, you know, I always like to bring the talks that we have in the context of whenever we're talking. And obviously right now there is a big conflict going on in the Middle East, Israel and Gaza. There is a conflict in Ukraine, and there is other wars that are not as, you know, televised or talked about. I feel very often, you know, if we look at humanity, and it feels like there is this quest for enlightenment and progress and evolution, and at the same time we go back to the same kind of patterns of behaviors which are very ancient. I mean, there was war in the Bhagavad Gita, right? There's war always. But I would love to kind of have your kind of view on, not a political view, I would say, on what's happening, but more from this lens, you know, those conflict that we are seeing, and especially the one we're seeing now. And you know, what is your connection through your lenses to what's happening, and what are we missing here? What is it that we can be so divided on issues that should, in some ways, we should probably find our humanity together. We should find our connection together. But there is this fear and resistance and pain that keeps producing this violence. And not just in the war, the capitalistic system is ultimately, I think, extremely violent, right? But what is that seed, you know, that is there that somehow humans have a very hard time to come to terms with or grow or change or shift?
What we're missing, you know, in my understanding, what we're missing is a basic somatic connection to what the Aboriginal traditions have called law. And law not as an externally imposed set of rules being handed down from an abstract God, but law again as this living breath of interconnectivity. So what's missing is the basic felt understanding that, in the words of Chief Seattle, what we do to the web of life, we do to ourselves. That's, you know, that fundamental experience of as it is with ecology, so is it with me. As it is with you, so it is with me. As you suffer, so I suffer. That basic felt experience can't be, we can't rationalize our way there, right? It's something that has to be felt. And because human beings are the beings that we are with our intense longings and urges, it has to be ritualized. We have to ritualize our experience of that deep interconnectivity. We need intensity in that ritual process. We need for the ritual process to like work with these deep primal longings that we have and, you know, blast through us in a way and shatter us sometimes. I'm sure you've been in ritual that has shattered you, right? Shatter us and then regrow us, but regrow us as interconnected with one another so that we feel the potency of community. Right. And all that need for intensity and all that need for, you know, that fire is alchemized. It's harnessed. It's harnessed in the fire of ritual. It's harnessed in the fire of art. It's harnessed in the fire of communal endeavor. Right. Instead, when we're removed from that, human beings have these primal longings. It's no accident that the age of reason, quote unquote, was the bloodiest era of human history. Right? It's no accident, right? Because we've compartmentalized these things and we've failed to deal with what are ultimately primal human needs and human longings. You know, traditionally cultures dealt with that, you know, what you could say is mostly male need for intensity, right? They've dealt with it through initiation ritual. They've dealt with it through like right at the point when, you know, boys are thinking to themselves like, hey, I'm a little stronger than that guy and I can push him around and I don't need to follow the rules of the elders. Right at that point, they're put in a situation where they are somatically reminded of their interconnectivity with everybody else. And when I say somatically reminded, that's a really gentle way of putting it. It's like they are
put through, poetic way of putting it.
They're put through the fire, right? They're put through the fire. And being put through the fire, something is alchemized and they're transformed from, you know, what Tyson Yonkaporta talks about, from like just me to us, us, us two, us together, right? So, you know, the law, quote unquote, that says that all things are connected, the law that says that the ecology's well-being is dependent on my well-being and my well-being is dependent on the ecology's well-being, that you and I have to find some kind of harmonic, you know, way of working with one another, you know, that must be in traditional visions ceremonially reinforced or else it's lost. And when it's lost, you know, all of the hidden drives, all of the things that we've been pushing down, right? War is the way that in the modern world, men feel eros and intensity and longing and trance states, and it comes through war. Like they find their passion, they find their, you know, deep chthonic longings, they find it through war. Whereas, you know, you look at old cultures, hunter-gatherer cultures, like the cultures in the Kalahari, you know, and they found it through trance and they found it through dancing, and they found it through repeated ceremony, intense ceremony, over and over and over and over and over and over again. So I look at the world today, and I see that the same, like you're talking about capitalism as violence, and the same consumptive fire that is driving like us to consume, consume, consume. You know, if you want to look elementally, animistically, what you can see is that there's a fire imbalance. There's a imbalance in our relationship with fire, right? The hunger fire, the fire of consumption, the fire of always burning our way forward as we consume, the fire of progress. It's no accident that Prometheus is the fire bringer, and the word Prometheus means the forward thinker, right? Like that relentless fire that we seem to have bought into, that like the purpose of human life is to be just relentlessly roving forward, you know? And then we look at war, and war is fire. It's incendiary devices. It's like the fire of war. This is a fire imbalance. If you want to get really deep into the animist vision, you can look at like the understanding in some traditions that humanity is possessed by fire elementals. That's a whole other way of looking at it that might be not familiar to everyone who's listening to this, but you know, knowing a bit about you, they may be familiar with this. But that, you know, the lesson of fire is that fire needs to be tempered, and we need to come into a healthy relationship with fire. And the fire of ritual is one of the tried and true ways to do this.
Yeah. I mean, in the Andean cosmology tradition, this fire, the shadow of the fire is anger. And the light of the fire is gratitude, right? It's a good fire, the fire that is, you know, maintained with good relations. But if you get too close or it gets too intense, you burn yourself, right? And yeah, that's the no of the fire. And that's our forest burning. That's our climate warming. That's the bomb blasting, right? That's this excess of fire that you're describing. So there's also that. Yeah, exactly that there. But, you know, we're not going to get everyone sitting around a sacred fire, I would say, because that's going to be difficult, right? But also,
I'm going to try my best.
But the leaders, you know, in ancient community, traditional communities, are the elders. And the elders, not just elders because they're old, they went through rite of passage, they kind of gained that title in a certain way. But we are in a culture that elects political leader in a very different way, right? We're not giving to the wise, you know. Very often we give to the powerful, the one that has the most money, that can control the power. And on top of that, we have a numbness. So we want to feel a lot, and I'm hearing on that the man wants to feel, right? But at the same time, there is a numbness that is required in order to be in this world. You know, John Amici say, if you don't wake up every morning and pray with the earth and cry, you're not really feeling her. If you don't have tears and grief every day. So we have disconnected from that grief because there's probably too much under there. So how do we get out of this mess in many ways that we want to be able to feel more, but there is so much to feel and there is no cultural context or cultural setting, ceremonies in order to do that, at least most of the time in any modern culture, right? Most of the time.
I mean, it has to happen breath by breath, heart to heart, story by story. It has to happen that way. And yes, there can be larger conversations, and I hope there are larger conversations that happen. But conversations can only provide a spark, and what is necessary is, you know, the regular repetitive embodiment of it. And until we get to that regular repetitive embodiment of it, you know, it takes a while to chip away at the numbness of modernity. Mm. It takes a while to really start to address some of these things. And so, you know, sometimes there are kind of like new age theologies of like, you know, it's all going to happen at once, or there's going to be some great big precipitating event that's going to wake everybody up. And you know, humanity is waking to certain things, you know, even at certain periods of human history, to have any talk of like, you know, basic human rights and this type of thing would have not been a discussion that most societies or civilizations wanted to have. There is a waking up that I feel is slowly happening within humanity, but it doesn't look like the precipitating event. It doesn't look like the, you know, the rapture. It doesn't look like, you know, one day the, you know, fifth dimensional whatever, so like, you know, open up all of our consciousnesses and we all see the things the exact same way. And to me, you know, the like beautiful trick of creation, you could say, is that what you're speaking about, that force of presence, that force of really ultimately what is love, that force of, you know, the shedding of the numbness and the opening of the soft inner being to the world around us and to the people around us. The trick of creation is that it's here. It's ever available. It's right in front of us. Right. And so as bad as things get, that promise of the natural world, you could say, you know, that it's really one breath away. One breath, we can shift our entire mode of interacting with each other and with the world. One ceremony and we walk out, you know, refreshed and renewed. And of course, we have to do that ceremony again. That's the way of human beings. We forget and we have to do it over and over and over again. But the fact that the thing at the center, the thing at the very center, the presence, the love, the feeling at the very center, the fact that that is here and ever available, that's, I think, the hope for humanity. Mm-hmm. That, you know, yes, it's going to be small communities opening up to it in their way, and it's going to be maybe not happening on the level of civilizational discourse, but on the level of, you know, rhizomatic growth between communities. But that over time creates massive, massive changes, massive changes. And I think that those changes are taking root. And I feel like, you know, you can look at what's going on in the world today and say, like I said earlier, like it's a mess and it's a pretty trying time in human history and this kind of thing. And I also have great hope. I also have great hope. And to me, like, you know, recognizing that at the heart of individual experience, there is a want to feel that connection, and there's a want to shed the numbness, and there's a want to shed the tears that need to be shed, and there's a want to come into what you could call good relation with one another. Like, recognizing that, not feeling other for it, because it's many more people than we think, you know. Like I was saying, like the number of people that I think feel the longing for this type of connection in the modern world, it's more than we think. And the number of people that are, you know, determined to destroy each other through violent means and this kind of thing is actually often smaller than we think. Mm-hmm. They just happen to have a lot of, you know, money and weaponry, right? So when you start with that premise that it's ever available and it's always there and it's one breath away, and that there are circles and concentric circles of others around us that want this too, then I think that you can start to, you know, launch a revolution or launch an evolution or however you want to describe it, you know. And I think that's happening. One of the things that I see over and over again is people in the modern West kind of feeling lost, separate, isolated, alone, and then not having like the 10,000 year tradition that they can just easily like slip back into and say, yeah, this is, you know, this is mine. And one of the things I'm exploring in the next episode of the podcast is that the songs of outcasts and exiles and wanderers are really powerful too.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're feeling separate, then one tried and true thing to do is sing of the separation, sing of the grief that we feel, sing of, you know, like what it is to be sundered from tradition in this modern world and how we can't quite seem to find our way back. And then we find that the singing of that separation is the way back.
Mm-hmm.
The singing of that separation is the way back. So that deep relationality doesn't always look like, you know, I am seamlessly integrating back into, you know, a 10 or 20,000 year old tradition of my ancestors. Sometimes that looks like I am showing up for the separation that I know exists. And in showing up for it and singing of it and diving into it a little deeper, perhaps, I find that there is a place that I carry with me in my own heart where all of the reconnection I need lives. And from there, from that place, I can start to rebuild reconnection with the people right around me and the plants right around me and the streams right around me, right? We can't force a relationship with place immediately, right? We have it as such an ideal, but we can't just snap our fingers and say, I am in perfect seamless communion with the streams in my watershed, right? It's a gradual process. And a big part of that process, I think, is first recognizing the separation that exists. And that separation isn't unique to one global community. You know, this is in many ways a world of what you could call orphans and exiles. And different peoples experience it in different ways, some more overt, some more ancestrally pronounced, right? But the nature of human beings, according to many traditions, is that we feel separate from the natural world. We feel separate. And so we, of all creatures, have to find our way back. And part of finding our way back is to understand that separation and to sing of it too. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. Do you feel like it started or it's, you know, weaved indeed with the separation with land? And, you know, understanding a little bit, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about what is your connection to land. I know you live in Hawaii now, but I'm sure, you know, you were not born there, I guess. So what has been your relationship to land over time? And how do you see it also as most of us are exiled in different countries and have moved and all of that? And there is a connection to the land that we have lost that an Aboriginal person will have, that someone in the Kalahari Desert will have, right? So people that have such a long connection to their songs, to the song line, to what is present in the land. And that created some kind of, I feel sometimes, original pain because we are missing that ancient mother that we can't really put a finger on, the grandmother that we have never known, but somehow is creating pain and potentially comes out in the ways of war and the ways of being incapable of relating because we're like a little toddler that is just screaming for his mommy sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the human story, right? And, you know, I get asked sometimes, like in study groups and stuff, like, when did the separation happen?
Mm.
You know, what was it? Like, what caused the separation? And it's interesting to see there are writers who kind of try to pinpoint it and say, oh, it was Descartes, and Descartes said this, and that, you know, separated mind and body, or it was the agricultural revolution.
I was going to say the apple, right? When
the right. Well, and that's interesting because tradition after tradition after tradition has its myths of separation.
Hmm.
And what's really interesting is that's not just limited to like European or Judeo-Christian cultures at all. You can find the most connected cultures. Like we were talking about Aboriginal traditions and like the Kalahari traditions, you can find the most connected cultures And they still have their stories of, well, why human beings feel separate, right? Mm-hmm. So what I feel is that there's something inherent in the human design. You can call it the higher brain function, quote unquote. You know, we of all creatures are kind of aware of a individualized separation, whereas like salamanders and, you know, gophers and owls may not be, right? They may feel, experience existence as more of a seamless flow, a continuum, a continuity. Human beings have a self-awareness that's a little bit different, you know? And what they're finding now about animal intelligence is obviously like animal intelligence is profound and deep and beautiful. And it's important to recognize that I think human beings have a particular quality of feeling a little bit separate. This is why human beings are traditionally, you know, traditional rituals, human beings are shapeshifters. Human beings, oh, I have to shift into the shape of the deer. I have to shift into the shape of the tiger or the antelope. I have to shift into these things because I myself am slightly separate. I'm slightly separate from the world. So what I feel about modernity is that we've taken something that is primal to human beings and just amplified it over thousands of years. That I think that all human beings in one way or another, you know, really all human beings, even those cultures of connection, still have to deal with issues of like, you know, separation, feeling other than the land, right? That's why you have to sing your way back over and over again, right? Because you feel separate. And then modernity has taken that separation. And yeah, I think every phase of the way, we've chosen the path that has created more separation, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with agriculture comes a certain type of separation. With written language comes literally a veil between direct experience and, you know, our direct experience of the world. With the rise of cities come actual walls that divide the world into nature, which is out there, and the city, which is over here, right? Each of these are gradations of separation that all come from, I believe, that primal separation magnified mm-hmm. over time. So I think, you know, it's important not to exoticize traditional cultures and say that every traditional culture feels this, again, seamless sense of union between them and place. You know, humans are humans. Traditional cultures just happen to have recognized it and ceremonialized it mm-hmm. and learned how to work with it from very early on. And that's what I think, you know, the lessons to be learned from traditional wisdom systems are about ritualizing our reconnection. Ritualizing our reconnection over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So land for me, you know, like it's interesting because I have a interweaving story of lineage practice, like family that was deeply rooted in lineage practice. And then lineage practice for me has shaped a huge part of my life. But then I also have the story of the modern exile wanderer, you know, like half this, half that, divorced parents, mom remarried, raised with my stepfather, but my mom's mom was divorced too at a time when divorce didn't happen so much. So there's waves and waves and waves of separation. Very working class Scottish ancestors on one side that like had to get out. They had to leave. You know, it was untenable for them to remain in their homeland, which is a sadness that I think a lot of people in the Western world carry with us, that exile story, right? So when I went back to Scotland, I immediately felt the connection to the land, like immediately. It was just like, I've dreamed of this place. I've felt this place in my bones, like the Highlands when we were going through it, you know? But what do you do when circumstances get so dire in that place when there's no opportunity and your family is stuck in successive waves of, you know, servitude and, you know, alcoholism and all this kind of thing. Like, what does a family do? Well, they leave, you know, they leave their place. And that story of exile, I think, is a story that's in many of us. When I grew up in the Buddhist center, it wasn't so much a connection to the land of that place. What really opened up my connection to place was when we moved to New Mexico, and I spent 23 years of my life in New Mexico. And New Mexico is a place where, first of all, I've talked about this in the an episode long time ago about enchanted land. Mm-hmm. Land that is still being traditionally sung to in the old ways has a different hum to it than land that is not. And New Mexico is a place where, like, the Pueblo cultures and the Diné culture there, they're still actively engaged with the land ceremonially. And that's part of it. There's a rawness to the land. And, you know, I grew up there. I spent my formative years there. And my first experience of animate land was there. And there were places that we used to go. And there was a place particularly that I lived for a summer when I was 17. You know, I in New Mexico, there also wasn't a whole lot to do. So I spent a lot of time in land. I would go out camping by myself at age 15. I would spend nights in the wilderness. And there was a what would now be called a primitive skills teacher there in New Mexico who was a deep mentor to some friends of mine and I would say casual teacher to me. And there was an entire ethos of, you know, of land. I would do extended backpacking trips and really, you know, and it somehow innately, I mean, I had a friend, I also in high school in New Mexico was exposed to the Lakota path through a friend and practiced in the Lakota tradition during my high school years and did Sweat Lodge. And, but there was a sense that every time I went out into land, I was going into the sacred wild. And I would build little shrines by the sides of the streams. And, you know, this is just how I naturally interacted with the land there. The land felt sacred and it reverberated. And yeah, there was one place when I was 17 years old that we, that I lived for the entire summer, and it's high desert, multicolored desert, stones of all varieties, chert and granite and sandstone and alabaster, sandstone of, you know, yellow sandstone, white sandstone, red sandstone, and a deep silence. And in that deep silence, a deep reverberation. And that was where I really started to have experiences of, all those things that I had learned in those stories, all the things in the Zen stories, all the talking animals and talking streams, and that's not a metaphor. That's where I really started to feel that.
You know, I'm alive.
It's alive, and it's not a metaphor. The fairy tales aren't metaphorical. The stories of the stories of the Pueblo cultures there—they're not metaphorical. They're real, and that embedded it in itself in me in a very deep way. And it's where some of the fundamental animacies that are present in the podcast arose. And yeah, my family's just gone through a very big transition, moving to be closer to my wife's family. And, you know, I feel it. I feel like, oh, I'm in land I haven't spent much time in before. And it's a big change. Yeah.
So, you know, earlier we talked about hope and hopelessness. And, you know, you shared you were hopeful about what's happening. I mean, the things that you see a little bit. In San Francisco, I thought you said you were really hopeless. And so both. Is it because it's Tuesday? Without kidding, I, you know, obviously I'm sure there is days where you're very helpful and days where you're not. But I feel there's a lot of people that are not. I feel despair and the world can be pretty daunting, you know, at time. And sometimes we need the good stories, right, to get us back into that joy. And sometimes we just need to stay with the pain and the hopelessness. Years ago, I met a Lakota elder, and I was asking him if he was hopeful. He was during the Keystone Pipeline fight, and he was there. And, you know, I said, do you have any hope for this to succeed, this fight? And he say, brother, he say, in our language, we don't have hope. We have prayers and action.
Mm.
You know, that really stayed with me, this idea, because we often hear people, I'm hopeless, or I hope things get better, right? It feels very disembodied to me, the term hope in some ways. So I just like, if you can talk a little bit about hope and hopelessness, where do you usually stand? Maybe you stand in both. But also, what is your, you talk about singing, right? To your hopelessness, mm-hmm. or to your pain, or to your grief, but what do you do when you're there? Or do you just sit with it and sing to it? Or do you just basically try to shift it? Do you bring a good story? Do you see the trickster in the corner trying to play with you? I mean, what does that space of hope and hopelessness that sometimes can be very seen well, right? Play for you.
I mean, it's interesting. I said those words today, but they're not really words that I use very often. I don't really get caught in the vernacular of hope and hopelessness too often, because, you know, what I see are, you know, what you could call, temporal waves of ignorance that are determining a lot of the story of humanity at this particular juncture.
Mm.
And those temporal waves of ignorance are, you know, really tough, really hard to deal with. It's sad what's happening to the world. It's the grief that we feel over what's happening is utterly warranted. And I feel that grief. And there are days that, you know, I feel that grief and I shed a lot of tears. And there are days that I'm called to compose poetry or sing of it. And there are days when really what there is to do is to be with others and share a meal and share some kind of sacred offering together. And this is a big piece in the individualist world. Like, we don't have to bear the grief of the world ourselves. And I think that, you know, there's a tendency, like, and I spoke about this in the last episode of the podcast, the previous episode on justice, you know, there's a tendency to, you know, not only feel the weight of the entire burden of the Anthropocene on our individual shoulders, but then also to magnify that through, like, then the thing that I have to do is to, like, unpack all aspects of the psychology of my individual bearing of the weight of all the, you know, and it can become a downward spiral pretty quick. And when I look at, you know, the time that I've spent living in other lands or, you know, in close contact with, you know, traditional systems, you know, that's when you have a meal together and that's when you sing some songs together, and it's always done together. And, you know, there are rituals of grieving that are deeply important and deeply valuable for moving things through, you know, but the ritual of grieving doesn't last forever. And there's stories about what happens when the grieving ritual goes on a little bit too long. There's a beautiful Scottish song about, you know, the spirit of a dead child coming back to the mother and saying, you've been grieving too long. Now it's time to just let go. So understanding that grief is a movement, and like that movement takes us and we want to honor it and celebrate it. But we don't have to like own it and individually amplify it, right? There's a relationship to be had there where, like, you know, certainly let's not repress it. Let's let it move through, you know? But as we let it move through, like, you know, grief and joy are also deeply intermingled, and joy often comes right on the heels of grief if we're open to just letting the grief move, you know, and not hanging on to it either. Right. So it's about being awake to the waves of feeling that arise. And, you know, within that, understanding that there's so much in the world that I would like to see different, like so much that I wish were different. I wish it could have been another way, as I said in an episode. And that to me induces grief and it makes me feel a lot. And then within that, understanding both that within myself, there is the chance and opportunity within myself and in my community, there's the chance and opportunity to connect to something eternal, that no matter what the external situation is, that we can connect to love and the spirit of sharing, you know, and at the same time, us together can connect to the vastness too. Mm-hmm. And in the vastness, from the perspective of the vastness, from the perspective of nature itself, you know, all this that we are going through as human beings is a wave. It's a particular wave. It's a wave that too shall pass when nature measures things in billion year time cycles and extinction level events happen all the time. And then life regenerates and the planet recomposes itself and the balance of nature reasserts itself. So it helps me to feel what I need to feel in terms of the immediate state that humanity is in, and then also know that there is a bigger movement that I and those around me can connect to. I try to balance these things out. Mm-hmm. I try to feel what I need to feel and do what I need to do and pray, like you're saying, like prayer is really powerful. Song is really powerful. Activism is powerful. I worked as a full-time activist for many years. The understanding that there is work to be done to address what's going on in the world, this is potent and powerful. And I think we need to keep in our hearts and in our practice a regular reconnection to what Omid Safi calls like spiritual replenishment, like replenishing ourselves, constantly renewing ourselves, you know, like things are going on in the world. And then you step into the sweat lodge and it heats up a little bit and you sing a few of those songs and things change dramatically, right? Things shift, things move. That type of replenishment and renewal in the midst of everything that's happening is deeply important. And it's how I navigate it.
Mm. Beautiful. Yeah. I was wondering, you know, if as a dad also, because you have children, young children, if you kind of shifted your practice, you know, and or maybe even your lenses in many ways as we become parents, right? And we're going to give this world to our children. Does it increase your activism, your prayer practice, your desire for change? You know, how does that influence and kind of lead into my last question here about, okay, today, so you're a dad, and do you see the world differently? Maybe you were seeing it 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, because of that seedling that is there. If it did change anything.
I mean, there was a time when my wife was pregnant with our first child, and I just had this overwhelming feeling of, I wish I'd made the world a better place for you to come into. Like, you know, feeling like, as someone who is an activist, like feeling that I'd failed somehow, not doing more to make this place better for the next generation. And, you know, and then that was tempered by this feeling of like, look what human beings have survived and endured, and look over the ages how every child in many ways has been born into a time of uncertainty. And yes, the uncertainties now are perhaps more magnified and more globally dire than they've been in certain ways. But life has always been a precarious proposition. You know, life has always been a precarious proposition. And within that, what matters most is our ability to connect to love and to be there for one another in love. And so, you know, I feel committed to doing what I can. The podcast, the work that I'm doing through the podcast, is a big part of how I hope to, you know, make a container nest architecture that my children can have some foundation in the world, so that, you know, they have that anchor. And then, you know, all throughout history, people have sat on the edges of, you know, great upheavals and battles and the trash heaps of history, and sang songs of great beauty and saw the glint in one another's eyes and shared a meal together and told a story around the fire. And that's the beauty of the human story. And that's something that's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere. So for me, parenthood has been a process of reconnection to that magic. The magic that says, in spite of everything, we survive. In spite of everything, we survive. And not just survive, in spite of everything, we thrive. Mm. In spite of everything, love flows in equal quantity to which it has always flowed, which is infinitely. You look into the eyes of a child and it's a portal into the infinite love of the universe. And that's not going anywhere.
Thank you, Josh. You have a training, a class, a circle, a ceremony coming up at the end of the year. I think you're bringing people again together. I don't know if you want to talk about it. I heard you announce it in the last podcast, but yeah, if you feel you love to hear a little bit about people that want maybe to connect with you or do some deep work, long journey with you, if you want to share that journey.
Sure. The podcast is called The Emerald, and there's a study group for patrons, and that's pretty easy to find, patreon.com/theemeraldpodcast. And then I offer a year-long deep dive into the foundations of mythic animate ritual tradition around the world. So it's a way of really seeking to deepen our knowledge in whatever tradition we're practicing in, to deepen our knowledge of what has been foundational practice for ritual and animate traditions. And I decided to do this because there's a lot of short form. There's plenty of courses these days. There's lots of great courses, you know, but in looking at what I really wanted to offer, I really see the value in these modern times of rush and forward agitation of deepening into study in a profound, deep way over time. So it's an online course that also has an in-person component, and it takes place over a year. And yeah, we'll be doing another group in November. And if people are interested in finding out more about that, the email address is themythicbody@gmail.com.
Perfect. And we'll be, you know, putting the links and the reference to all of that under here, the podcast and the video. Thank you so much, Josh. Thank you for...
Thank you. And thanks. I know it took us a few months to get this together, and I
appreciate
okay.
That's okay. Yeah. Thanks for sharing all this wisdom, and I hope everyone who are listening today, you enjoy as much as I did. And yeah, safe travel, safe journey. Thank you for the connection today. Thank you, everyone.
Really nice to talk with you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Sanctuary Podcast. We deeply value your support. Please consider sharing this podcast with others and joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Once again, it is patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. At The Sanctuary, we believe that spirituality is a personal journey that takes many forms. and we honor and respect all paths to awakening and the rise of consciousness. Our mission is to provide a platform for open and honest conversations about spirituality and to inspire and empower our listeners to live their most authentic lives in good relation to each other's, the living and invisible worlds. I look forward to connecting with you again here or at our events, retreats, and online gatherings. You can find all our offerings at thesanctuaryheal.com. Once again, it is thesanctuaryheal.com.